You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A daughter of Filipino farm workers in the Sacramento Valley rose to become the top jurist in California, overseeing the nation's largest court system. That's the story of Tani Cantil Sacauye, who became the first person of color and second woman to be appointed Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. But after a 12-year term, Cantil Sacauye announced she will retire. Appointed by then-Governor Schwarzenegger, the Chief Justice is credited with guiding the court through two big crises, the Great Recession and the COVID-19 pandemic. Her departure could also shift the ideological makeup of the court further to the left. Cantil Sacauye was appointed as a Republican, but changed to no party preference in 2018. And just last week, Governor Newsom nominated Justice Patricia Guerrero to take her place, who joined the court in March of this year, and if appointed, would become the first Latina Chief Justice. I spoke with Chief Justice Cantil Sacauye about her career and legacy, and the biggest challenges facing her successor.
Well, you grew up in Sacramento, and you graduated from UC Davis. I'd like to go back to kind of the beginning. What was it about your background that drew you to law?
Thank you for that question. Well, I come from a very strong Filipino community. Everyone, at least in that wave of immigrants, were farm laborers. And so we were unified because my mother picked crops and had grown up traveling from crop to crop. And there were hardships along the way and changes in school and discrimination. And my grandmother had difficulties with title to her home. And I was aware of these things, aware that one of my uncles had to leave the state to marry his French wife. So I grew up with a lot of strange happenings and a curiosity about that, even including being evicted from our home in downtown Sacramento in those days, and my mother's feeling of just disappointment and being awash in shock and sorrow that we were losing our family home. So I'd been surrounded by odd and peculiar happenings that didn't make any sense.
Were you a child when you decided that you would want to go to law school or at least pursue a profession in law?
I was not. I didn't make that decision early on at all because no one in my family had gone on to college or at that point. But I had seen the first Filipina lawyer who came to our community, and my mother took me to see her. And she gave me the elbow and said, "You could do that." And my mom was not a woman who was easily impressed. And the fact that I was there with her watching some stranger meant something. It was later on in community college when I was thinking about going on to law school.
When you touch upon the fact that your family faced eviction, and so that's an experience with the justice system that was pretty young for you and early on in your life. How did that shape the way you judge as a person?
It shaped me to this day, not only in how I perform my professional work, but just how I live my life and raise my kids. And that is that government has actions that affect people's real lives and have effect long term and creates memories and feelings about government and about how people were treated. So in all respects, in my view, we can never know what's going on in someone's life, and we can only hope that we can endeavor to treat them with respect and dignity as these things happen, because sometimes we're helpless, but the best we can be is not part of a machine that makes them feel alienated.
Your career as a judge or in the legal system spans decades, the last 12 of which were as California's Supreme Court Chief Justice, which made you the first person of color and only the second woman to serve in that role. What do milestones like first and second mean to you?
While they're happening, they don't feel like a milestone. They feel like I need to get in here and roll up my sleeves and do this work that I'm privileged to do. It doesn't feel like a milestone, I suppose, because everyone, at least when I came to this court, they were so welcoming. They didn't know me, but they clearly respected the office here at the Supreme Court. So though I was new to them, and they were iconic to me because they were the Supreme Court and I had been a trial judge and an appellate justice, they were gracious, and it felt like I was part of a family, and they were good and respectful, and we worked together well. So it it didn't feel in the moment like this is a huge accomplishment. It felt like this is a welcoming place to be.
You're appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger, and, you know, in your announcement that you were going to retire, you said that your career is really bookended by the Great Recession and also a global pandemic. What do you believe were the key factors in the court in terms of successfully weathering these two huge external challenges?
Thank you. Yes, I took office as Chief Justice in 2010 and became the leader head of the largest law-trained judiciary, not only in the country, but probably the world, and the most diverse. And so we depend on public funding. And public funding, as you might recall, 12 years ago was being slashed, and we didn't know the end, and they wouldn't spend a dollar to save five. We were closing courtrooms, courthouses, appellate justices like myself and some trial judges. We took pay cuts. We worked a day without pay in order to keep the doors open. And so it really meant at that time to spread the word. We are in need of a functioning judicial system, and we need to first clean ourselves up. We need to cut corners. We need to do an audit. We need to make ourselves fit for the long haul at a budget. And so I went in and I surveyed, and I went in and let people go took a survey, determined what we could downsize. And also at that point, I engaged the lawyers, our best advocates of California, explained our budget, needed them in the legislature and in the governor's office to help also spread our message that you need an adequate, sustainable court in order to be there for justice. Because while the Great Recession is going on, people's lives are folding. We need to be open. And it took a few years, but we accomplished our goal. We made friends. We made comrades. We have people understand the branch better. And now in my final year, we brought home the largest judicial branch budget in its history.
Fast forward to a pandemic, which severely impacted the court system and courts across the country. How did that impact the job that you did every day?
It was, like everyone, unprecedented. And we had no playbook. All I knew is we were going to stay open. We are staying open, damn it. And we're going to find a way to make this work. All of the courts were in various stages of accessing justice through remote technology, and we sped it up. And we had the goodwill of the judges and the lawyers and the court staff, and we all rode in the same direction. And we brought along people who were doubters, and there were some who didn't take to it, but the majority of judges and the majority of lawyers and professional staff, we understood our public service role. And we endeavored to do it. Was it perfect? Could it have been much better? Sure. But at the time we were, as they said, I said, we're on the bullet train and we're throwing out the track as we're going in front of us. So I'm proud of the work we've done and how we've maintained and able to keep our doors open. And now looking at best practices that we learn to keep and to use at the user client's option.
Just like everything, everything got slowed down tremendously. What are the challenges that still exist because of the pandemic?
Well, because of the pandemic, as you know, every state and all the counties and the cities had different overlapping health orders, but all of them had a social distancing order and also had stay away or shelter in place orders. Courthouses are buildings, and we normally bring in on every day, we call in 200 or 300 jurors to hear the jury trials. And at this point during pandemic, we couldn't bring in enough people with social distancing. We just don't have that room. So we were bringing in smaller groups of people like 25 and 50 in order to vet for jury service. Also, we had the difficulty of jail and prisons having their own outbreaks. So we couldn't transport people who for their day in court because they were under quarantine, they were infected, and it would infect employees and court staff and court watchers. We also had the added problem of the fact that shelter in place, jurors weren't coming even though they were being subpoenaed, understandably. So we had to suspend jury trials because we just couldn't go through with them. So as a result, in some counties now, we have a backlog of jury trials in felonies and an unlimited civil. We've managed, though, in other categories with remote access, to actually address backlog and get ahead of our caseload, particularly in civil, like family law and dependency, child welfare cases, because juveniles are more apt to want to handle their case remotely. And they want to do it at the kitchen table, and they bring their parents along to do it. And so we've been able to really reach a population and be more inclusive in family law matters.
Yeah, because ultimately, when you're talking about these cases, they impact everyday lives, which you just, what we started our conversation with.
Yes, yes. And as you know, in times of great crisis in the state, that's when justice is needed most, because people are laid off, they're losing their homes, there's wage theft, there's corruption, there's theft, there's a lot of conservatorship issues, dependency issues, families are having challenges, and they need court services. And so we really see our role as even stronger in times of crisis.
When it comes to California's third branch of government, it's not necessarily, you know, the center of everyday conversations. What do you wish people knew more about the California Supreme Court?
Well, I thank you. You're absolutely right. The judicial branch is a bit shrouded in mystery, and it's a little more complicated. But I wish what people knew about the Supreme Court and the courts of appeal and the trial courts is that we are a third branch of government, like the other two, co-equal, and we are dedicated, longtime career public servants, providing access to justice. And we are making an effort to make the courts accessible to you. We are public servants. We take that role seriously. And we also want you to know that the courts exist for you to press your rights. The legislature passes proposals, the governor signs those proposals into law, but it is in the judicial branch that we enforce those laws and clarify them for you. So we're a service organization, and it's important that the courts not be forgotten, because if you defund or you end up marginalizing the funding of the courts, you're only really inflicting harm upon yourself should you ever need to turn to justice.
Right, because your budget can change drastically, and probably has over the last 12 years that you've been Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Frighteningly so. And it's part because we are such a tiny sliver of the state budget general tax pie. We're a tiny little sliver, and we're also the sliver that is basically discretionary income. Other parts are mandated funding, of course, for social services, for education, a lot of those, understandably. But we're so tiny, but we're also vulnerable because there is no minimum floor to funding the judiciary.
When it comes to your retirement, this is your last year. When did you begin thinking about retirement?
Well, I could have retired 3 years ago, right before the pandemic, but I wasn't ready. There were still things that I wanted to, with others, pull across the finish line. And so in this year, I thought about it knowing I'd have to re-up. I've said there's no reason for me to think about leaving except for now I have to re-up. And re-upping means I have to think about whether or not I can give another 12 years fully to this job. And then I have to think, and I thought, well, I've had 32 years as a jurist. Would I do 12 more? Or would it be better to have someone come in fresh and start his or her administration and take the branch in yet other expansive ways? So it was really thinking about the future and how long I would stay with 12, because retention was imminent. And so that's what started me to think about it and to really sort of drill down to how many more years, and if, for example, if there were a recession that were coming, and as has been rumored in the media, I would not feel right leaving in the middle of it. So I would have to ride that out. And I don't know how many years that would be. And so those were the kinds of things that led me to think about not re-upping this year.
Is it bittersweet?
Yes, it is, as all huge decisions are.
Governor Newsom just recently nominated Justice Patricia Guerrero to take your place as Chief Justice, who was just sworn into the Supreme Court in March of this year. Did that nomination come as a surprise to you, given it's only been, you know, about 5 months?
Oh, absolutely not. I do sit on COJA as the Commission on Judicial Appointments Chair. I probably can't gush because we haven't had her hearing, but I will say Governor Newsom made a fine choice. I congratulate him on it. And she has 5 more months than I had when I came on. I came on from the Court of Appeal. So she's going to be great. And she's in the branch is in good hands. And I'm not surprised.
Not only the third woman following you, but the first Latina to yes. serve in this role.
Yes, very exciting for the justice, very exciting for California, very exciting nationally as well.
I want to go back just, you know, about 4 years ago when you publicly renounced your Republican Party affiliation and you switched to no party preference. And that was in the wake of the confirmation hearings for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. What happened during the course of those hearings that made you want to switch from the Republican Party to no party preference?
Thank you. That's a great question, because I had been thinking prior to hearing and watching it to changing to no party preference, because as judges, we don't have a party, really. It has a political denomination, makes no difference to the work we do. And I'd been thinking at it for some time. I just didn't have reason to act upon it. But during those hearings, I saw that it felt like to me a little bit of a undermining of the whole public policy and the judiciary. And I have two adult daughters who were younger adults then, and I tried to see it through their eyes. And at the same time, some of the questioning and the way of the questioning, I can't put my finger on it, but it was reminiscent to me of the time when I was a young trial attorney, prosecutor, the only woman in the courtroom. And the environment was not comfortable. And I hadn't seen that in a long time. And I hadn't even really thought about it. But watching those, I remember I had my earbuds in, and I'm going through the airport and I'm traveling for work and I am fixated on this hearing. And I came away with a bit of kind of deja vu a little bit. I just felt that it was time to make the decision. And I didn't announce it. I didn't think it would be a big deal. I just changed it and told my folks, you probably should change my bio. And it surprised me that the press found it some months later.
Yeah, I read about it in the Associated Press at that time. When it comes to politics, I understand your position is impartial as a judge. How has your view, though, of politics changed throughout the course of working in law?
Well, I believe definitely we've seen policies change in the last decade, and that's natural and fluid and important and that necessary. Every generation decides how it's going to craft and the laws that guide its community, its society. And that's something I respect as a jurist and respect as a person. At first glance, I may think this is not what I'm used to, but I don't know that it's wrong. And so I think it's up to the decision makers who are answerable to the public and their constituents to decide what they think is the best direction for California. And as jurists, as you know, we often say in some of our more controversial opinions, we say, we do not opine on the wisdom of this policy, because we just don't. That's not our role in a democracy.
Well, what I'm hearing is listening and staying open-minded are key. But a part of that is also having diverse viewpoints. And you switched your party affiliation to no party preference, but previously were a Republican. When you retire, there will only be one Republican appointee left on the court. We have a state legislature that is overwhelmingly Democrat, our governor as well. Are you concerned the court, or even in California, politically, may be shifting too far in one direction?
I don't have that fear. I know that when you have 7 principled people, my colleagues, weigh in, that there's no room for politics. Our positions are supported by authority and citation. And if there isn't support, or we'll even say to each other, I read this paragraph, do you have any authority, legal authority or citation in support of that before we say it. I'm not comfortable saying that without some legal authority with which I agree is pertinent. So I don't see it. Our opinions are written publicly to be read and to be checked and fact-checked. And so I think that's the judiciary, maybe more than any other branch of government, relies on public trust and confidence in the work we do. And we do it in a transparent way where you can read it. If it sounds, it starts to sound and read politically because of political views, then we've failed in our job.
Do you think that trust has been eroded in recent years, especially in light of recent Supreme Court decisions, and this is at the national level, that have been divisive and have prompted people to demonstrate and protest for one position or the other?
I think that's a pretty accurate statement. I believe that there is far more discussion about court decisions and the United States Supreme Court decisions in particular. I think there is a risk of that at the high court, which I hope people begin to understand is very different from how state court operates. We are not lifetime appointed. Justice Guerrero is going to have to run for a 12-year term. But no, I do firmly believe that we are in times like we've never been, where the court's legitimacy and its objectivity is at issue.
In the past 12 years, you've presided over and penned some big decisions. Is there a specific case or decision that you presided over that will stick with you and perhaps will have the most significant impact on current and future Californians?
I think that all of our cases at the Supreme Court, whether I authored them or my colleagues did, are all significant because they wouldn't be here if they weren't. We don't grant review on many cases, but the ones we do are because they are statewide importance and impactful. I don't think any one case stands out to me. I think what stands out and what is impactful is that we work together collegially and we are not divisive. And so I think the California Supreme Court has historically, and through me still, has been able to be of service to the public and litigants because we clarify and guide the law in a way that you won't have to worry that next year one vote will change it.
Your retirement is the close of a chapter. You also believe that each generation must renew and refresh our constitutional democracy. What does that look like to you?
That means that those of us who are the stewards in these positions really need to be out in the community describing the public service work that we do and that our sister branches do, and that we describe civics and critical thinking and collaboration, that we tell our young people and maybe even remind some of our middle-aged and old people like myself that we need to preserve and we need to work together for this government. And that means understanding it, and it means civility, and it means respect for each other's points of view, which I really tried to work and push a civics initiative for K through 12, with the judiciary leading the way in such a way that because we're leading, we're going to emphasize the judiciary, but we are also including our executive and legislative branches, and judges and lawyers are out there every day as part of the Power of Democracy civics initiative started here by, that I started in 2012.
Oh, so for about 10 years now.
Yes.
Finally, 4 months from now, your term ends. Any idea? Have you been mulling over what you're going to be doing, what 2023 looks like?
I haven't had a lot of mulling because life here at the court goes on and we are still sprinting. I have a moment's abstract thought about the fact that come January 2023, my email box won't be filled with crises and exclamation points and urgents. Urgent! I hope that I never really see that again. But I don't know, but I'm kind of excited about a new adventure. I'm excited about, I have faith. I believe a little bit in fate. I'm excited to see what the next brings, if anything.
Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for your interest. Nice talking with you, Vicky.
That is my conversation with Tani Cantillo-Sacaulle, the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, who will retire at the end of the year. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.